Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Nathan M. Hall is a witch, animist, initiate of the Anderson Fairy tradition, and member of the Temple of Witchcraft. He serves on the board of the annual Mystic South Conference and is a contributor and editorial advisor to The Wild Hunt, a daily news source for the pagan community. Nathan has 2 decades of experience working as a journalist and editor and has lectured at media conferences and has sat on a variety of panels. His new book is Path of the Moonlit Hedge, out from Llewellyn in May 2023. Nathan Hall, welcome to Witchlit.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. and I'm excited to talk about all the different ways you write and contribute to the pagan sphere, whatever you want to call it.
I'm excited.
Yeah,
grateful for the chance.
Yeah, thanks. Our first question for everybody on the show, though, is why write?
I've been writing for most of my life. I think I wanted to be a writer when I was a kid, when I was a real little kid. So writing for me is just kind of, it is a function of my life. I don't even really think about it. I don't even actually plan for it. It's just something that I do. Mm-hmm. So.
So what was the impetus from going from like kind of more journalistic writing to writing Path of the Moonlit Hedge? Like, how did that evolve?
Well, I spent about 10 years ago a while trying to write some fiction. I wrote about 2.5 books, never saw the light of day. I don't know if they ever will see the light of day, but it was a good experience. And that got me like, it really got me into the, you know, wanting to write a book bug and getting something actually published. You know, I think anybody who has, you know, who writes at a book length level in the first place kind of wants to be published. It's just sort of one of those like goals that you end up setting for yourself. And so that's why I knew that I wasn't going to do anything book length journalistically, and or at least not now. Mm-hmm. So I decided, you know, I am friends with someone who works at Llewellyn, and she's like, if you ever have any thoughts, just pitch them my way. So I did. I pitched a few things over the years, and she was like, nah, 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 none of that works. And then finally, this I sent to her, and she was like, oh, this is really interesting. I think this might go somewhere. So then she took it to Llewellyn, and they approved it. So
nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's important for people to hear that there were a lot of pitches before that.
Yeah.
I think we've had a lot of people on the show go like, I just pitched this thing and I got a book deal. I'm like, yeah, it's always worked that way.
it's so true. And like, I think it was good to have rejections because it made me think harder about what I was pitching and think more deeply about it. It made me develop a premise more than I would have if it had just been like one random pitch and it was approved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and because of that, I actually, Llewellyn decided to split my book in two. So I signed a 2-book contract with them on this one because they were like, this is great, but all of this other stuff is in a second volume that comes later. And you need to kind of ease people in, have some introductory material, and because there was a lot there. So rather than having a 400 page book, they decided maybe to have this and then another volume after.
Yeah. I think that's interesting. I do wonder, like, do you think that you, because you knew you were pitching to Llewellyn, kind of looked more at like what Llewellyn publishes and what they kind of want, and maybe if you just done like a broader pitch?
I think I definitely pitched to Llewellyn knowing what they do. It was hard for me to agree to splitting the book in two, because frankly Llewellyn does have a sort of like, they publish a lot of introductory material. They publish a lot of material that's accessible to people who are just starting their journey, or maybe in, you know, the early to mid stages of their spiritual journey. And I don't think that's the case across the board for everything that they publish, but that's sort of the reputation that they have, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was hard for me to agree to do a book that, you know, like this book to me feels like I do delve into, I go deeply in a couple of areas, but I'm also, some of the material at the front of the book is a little more introductory. And, you know, I was like, well, I just want to do my thing. And they're like, well, you have to bring people in and ease them mm-hmm. into it. So yeah, it was.
Yeah, I do kind of wonder, like, I mean, I think you're right. I think Llewellyn does have this, is kind of known. I don't really want to say reputation, because I think maybe that's a negative connotation. But yeah. I think they are kind of known for, like you said, more, like all of their books kind of have this, I guess when they're introducing like a way of practice, like here's the basics. Like, yeah. And I feel like, and because I've read so many Llewellyn books lately, that the thing I have to remind myself is nobody is reading this many of their books.
Right.
You know, like most people are not reading like, you know, 10 Llewellyn books over the course of a couple of weeks. Right. but I do think it is there that you see that kind of pattern in the book of like, here's the introductory material. A lot of it starts with like learning mindfulness and meditation, which I think is really key and important to more advanced concepts. And it's the thing that has been really interesting is to look at all of the different ways people approach it.
Yeah.
And I think that to me is kind of fascinating. And it's like, I always think about, I think I've talked about this on the show before. It's like every book is a different door you can walk through.
Right.
And so depending on which book you pick up first, this is going to be your, you know, your introduction to it. So I see their rationale in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think there are a lot of us who are like, I want like a 201, 301 master thesis class on this topic. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And hopefully the next one will get there for me. But
yeah. Well, that's exciting. So are you writing, you're writing that now, or it's done mostly?
It's not done. I'm doing the sort of research, background writing, doing all of that while dealing with my book launch that's happening right now. So that has been like a full-time job. Yeah. I have contacted every witchy, metaphysical, whatever store that I could find, basically east of the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are tons and tons that I've missed, but I've actually like personally sent out like mailers and promotional material and a personal message to all of these different shops.
Oh, nice.
Introducing myself, introducing the book. And it's, you know, I have some background in like marketing through journalism, you know, my journalism job.
Right.
So I know effective ways to sort of do that. But it's not something that I really wanted to do either. It's very time consuming. So
if listeners picked up on perhaps some smiling going on, my cat just walked in front of the camera with his tail up in the air. But I think that's probably a boon to you, because I think a lot of writers come into it not really knowing how to do any kind of marketing, and that's not really how it works anymore.
Yeah.
I think that's, for sure. That's really good. I also wish, if someone is listening that needs a project, I wish there was a master list of metaphysical and witchy shops somewhere.
I'm making one
that people could tap into. Good. Cause it's just like, it's such a resource that we need and no one has it right now.
Yeah. I think so. Something that I've been thinking about doing is I have it as a Google sheet, and it's just name of the store, email address, physical address, and I think their URL as well.
Yeah.
And And for me, I have on there information about like when I mail, you know, when I contacted mm-hmm. them, when I emailed them, when I sent them a physical letter, did they ever respond? Did I respond back to that? Blah, blah, blah. It's just like my project management mind mm-hmm. trying to stay on top of everything.
It sounds like the spreadsheet I keep for the podcast. It sounds very similar. Yeah.
So, but I'm thinking like, to your point, I'm thinking about maybe taking that, making a copy of it and stripping out all of my stuff and just making a public document mm-hmm. that people can edit. And then we can collectively.
Oh, this place is closed. This place opened.
Yeah. Or people can add new stores or whatever they want to do. So
yeah.
I'm thinking about doing that. I just don't know if I want to be the person that maintains it.
Yeah. Well, I think making it a public document can be really helpful because I do think, you know, it's one of the things I miss about Witchfox, like the demise of Witchfox was such a loss.
Yeah.
And like I think having something like that available to people, especially to authors or anybody who's trying to get in contact with those folks. Like we're a publisher and we're publishing a lot of books that are, you know, in this space. And even as a publisher, I don't have a way to directly reach out to so many places. So it would be great. It would be a great resource.
You know what I started I did this. I just went on Google Maps and I put in which store mm-hmm. in the search. And then I just zoomed into different areas around the United States.
Yeah.
And I found that which store kind of like cut out some of the more new agey stores that mm-hmm. maybe wouldn't want to carry my book in the first place.
Yeah.
So I don't know. And I just did that. Like literally I've probably spent a dozen hours working on that. Create that document.
It's those things take so much time. I in a previous job just had to do like a landscape sheet of like farmers markets.
Okay.
Want to talk about something that's ephemeral and hard to track down.
Oh yeah, no kidding.
They don't even always have the same location.
Right.
And it took me I probably worked on that thing for a solid 6 months off and on just trying to get it. And even by the time I gave it, you know, gave it to the people who wanted it, I was like, I can't guarantee that this is up to date.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you, and that's the other part is like, I mean, way back in the 90s, I was working somewhere where they just needed you to call to make sure businesses were still open.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just like a call center job kind of thing. And I would just like call the number. And then if somebody would say hello, you just hang up and that's it. The number's still active or whatever. So, but it was, just checking on these businesses to make sure that they were still open. And now we have a lot more technology, but it still seems to be as time consuming.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I just think there's so much like legacy stuff online now too, that like the site hasn't been updated since like 2015 or like 2003, you know, and you're like, okay, well, this data is obviously not good, or I can't rely on this data kind of thing. But but that is more marketing
than
writing. Although we do talk about marketing on the show sometimes too, because it, like I said, you have to do it. If you're going to publish, you've got to be able to do that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
But one of the things I really enjoyed about the book, and I think this is one of the things that I like about witchy books in the era that we're in, is there's a lot of you in the book. Yeah. There's a lot of your personal practice, your personal story. And I obviously have not read everything you've written as a journalist.
No.
So I don't know if this is a big departure from that, but was that different to kind of write this, like, it's not really witchy memoir because that's not the whole book, but it is like sharing a lot of your personal story and your road to where you are. So what was that like for you?
You know, I actually had to fight to get that in there and to keep that stuff in there. Mm-hmm. For me, that's how I relate to like to your point about, you know, books, you know, witchy books have been in the past felt more like, I don't know if I want to say academic, but just a little, you know, like there's not a lot of personal anything in it. You know,
dry. You know, I mean, I would say they're a little dry. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't care for that style. Like, it's not what I want to read.
Mm-hmm.
I'll read it if I feel like the information is good, but I really do enjoy anecdotes from a person's life. It draws their story closer to me. And I've always written in this style where it's almost like a confessional sort of tone. And it's probably, I mean, my editor was like, "You're writing too bloggy." And I'm like, "This isn't bloggy. What are you talking about?" But I think she was, kind of keying in on the confessional style. And I was like, that's just how I write. I mean, there's always going to be me sharing portions of my life in my writing. That's just how I do it. I can't imagine writing any other way. Journalistically, of course, you remove yourself from the whole, from everything. And I do enough of that kind of editing and writing in the first place. So if I'm doing something that I'm going to put my name on and, publish it as a book, I want it to be sort of a reflection of who I am.
Yeah. I think that's interesting that they refer to it as blogging, because I think about confessional writing really so predates blogging genre. Like, confessional writing is just a style that's been around forever.
Yeah.
But I think it just, in addition to making, for me too, the books more interesting, is that you really see these concepts applied in a way that I think if you're just getting a spell with no background or no understanding of where the person's coming from, it's just not the same. It's not as rich a text to me as when you get like, oh, this is my experience. It also makes me trust the author a little more too, that it isn't just a recipe book kind of thing.
Right. You're seeing that I've done it. You're seeing that I've done the work. I'm telling you how I developed it and everything. With the chapter on like fungi. I mean, that was really how it all came together. It was, me developing, like, first of all, noticing, and then, developing a relationship over time with this, with these mushrooms that were growing near my house. And I felt like, and that including that in the book was like, I don't know if this fits. And now it's like, it's one of my favorite parts of the book. And several people have been like, this is really an interesting section. Like, how did, why did, I got a lot of questions about it. So,
I will say it was one of the parts of the book that I was like, oh, this is new. This is new information, because I have been fascinated with the mycelial network of trees. Yeah. And I've read a lot over the last couple of years about tree communication. And I read The Overstory, that giant novel by Richard. Oh, what is his last name?
Can't remember right now.
I can't either. But that book is just brilliant. And I will tell people, though, it's really long. And if you dive in, be prepared. But it's brilliant. And the audiobook is amazing too. So it was just like, yes. And that, when I first learned about that, the mycelial network and all of this stuff and how that all comes together, like, it just immediately felt like, oh, this is animism in the world. Like, people can see this in a way that, I think it's easy to think everything is disconnected and you're like, oh no,
no,
this is like concrete, proof that these things exist. And so to me, it always seemed very witchy anyway. And so to bring that in and to think about it, and then to also expand upon it as a way to look at things and even talk about it, like how, in the Star Trek world, this like fictional idea of it and how that could even be an expansion of the idea. And I was like, okay, this is really cool.
I started really going down. I think that's somewhere that I'm going to dig into more in my next book. But like the idea of psychic bilocation and things like that, where it's, it gets real out there real quick. You don't have to think too hard about it before you're like, whoa, what am I?
Yeah.
Am I on mushrooms thinking about this?
Yeah. Like, I mean, just thinking about like quantum physics breaks my brain a little.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
in like a really good way.
Yeah.
And I don't know. To me, even though people are like, oh, materialist science and witchcraft yeah. can't exist. And I was like, have you read science lately? It's not that yeah. materialist.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. That's the encouraging thing for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Some of the new stuff that's, you know, there are some definite flavors of animism that are kind of, I mean, even like the field consciousness theory, mm-hmm. you know, where, you know, consciousness is not a property of our brains, but is a property of the universe that our brains are just sort of tapping into.
Yeah.
It's just a wild idea. And it's, you know, I read about it in a science magazine, you know, that yeah. was my first exposure to the idea. So, mm-hmm. It's encouraging to see, you know, because it can be frustrating having like an animist perspective. And I really enjoy science and I enjoy the exploration of things, but the materialist sort of has become almost religious within the sciences. And to see it sort of start to escape that is refreshing.
Yeah. Yeah. I love, like just the edges of science to me are always interesting. And I know, I think that like field consciousness idea and like that, the multiverse idea.
Yeah.
And like, you know, when you think about the multiverse and then you think about things like psychic bilocation, you're like, oh,
yeah.
Well, maybe. It
makes perfect
yeah.
sense.
Yeah. Yeah. You're like, okay, well, is this connected? Yeah, yeah. Like, I just love the idea that, I mean, I have a friend who is a scientist who's also a witch, and she always says witchcraft is just science we haven't explained yet.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, okay. You know, like, yeah. part of me always agrees with her. And then part of me is like, well, maybe it's more. But then I was like, yeah. well, then we figure out what that more is. And then maybe there are things that we can't know and won't know
yeah.
while we exist as a species, but that's okay right. too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, we're still completely flummoxed by, you know, dark matter and dark energy. There's huge, you know, huge amounts of the universe that we can't even see. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love, you know, I mean, part of the, I think the field consciousness theory and like one of the things that, and this is not Victoria Wapsing science-y because I'm not a scientist, but one of the things I thought was interesting about it is like, you know, we have all these explanations for why people fall in love, like these chemical kind of things. And I was like, well, if you expand that idea out, it's just the universe falling in love with itself, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's.
I love that. Yeah.
You can get really, weirdly new agey if you go yeah. out there too far, but yeah. like it just kind of like, it's almost like the things that we feel intrinsically sometimes are the things intuitively that we think about. And then you find out later, like, oh no, there's a reason behind that.
Yeah.
Is fascinating to me.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And that's kind of, you know, where my animism lies is in that territory where, as you said, it's the universe falling in love with itself. Like, ultimately, I don't see division between, you know, any of us, any of the other than human beings that mm-hmm. that we interact with. And it does get real woo-woo real quick. But, you know, to me, it's just like, this is the soup I'm swimming in, you know, right. it's.
Yeah. And I think for me, it's like, I think there was a point in my life where like I wanted to understand everything. Like I just needed yeah. to know. And now yeah. I'm more like, I'm comfortable with the mystery. Like yeah. that's okay too, you know, and maybe absolutely. That just comes with age or exhaustion. I don't know. but yeah, no, like living with the mystery is its own kind of beauty.
Yeah, absolutely.
But so I'm curious how, like talking about that subject in a book, like how do you lead people into that? Like how do you, this conversation between us is not the same yeah. as someone picking up a book and reading about it. So how do you, is that part of like the process of the second book?
In a way, for me, it just quickly gets into, I think, you know, this is where I end up just being like, it's just the star goddess or it's just the universe. And mm-hmm. like, you know, like we are the universe. We are the universe. There's a famous quote, we are the universe experiencing itself. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's a cliche. I don't know. But it is a fundamental, truth. It's in my worldview, it's, there is not, the separation is an illusion, mm-hmm. between people, between animals, between whatever, we are all the material of the universe, and the energy of the universe. So that's kind of where I take it. And, I get real deep with it sometimes, but it will be something that I have to dig more deeply into to get into print, mm-hmm. And have it make any amount of sense.
It's a topic we've been thinking about for a long time as people, as witches, as just humans. And, I think, what is it, the Arthur C. Clarke quote about, sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic, or,
Right.
And I don't know, the thing that has been like the edge area for me with like my animism is like, okay, it's become almost second nature for me to think there's no separation between like me and other people, me and plants, me and other animals, like, but what about like the house I'm in? What about like my car, my computer, like the clothes I wear every day? That kind of stuff. Like, how do I bridge that gap? Seems bigger, because we still have this constructed world division a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something that I was just doing a workshop a couple weeks ago, and this very thing came up. What about manufactured things? Mm-hmm. Are they ensouled? Are they inspirited? And, my answer is, it's, I work with the spirit of my computer every day, and, my car and things like that. Just because it's manufactured doesn't mean, even going even more into the sci-fi realm, is there a spirit of AI, and can you work with that? Do you want to work with that? And like it definitely gets into, it feels like it goes beyond spirituality into like a weird sci-fi theoretical realm or something.
Yeah.
But in my practice, everything, even parts of things, like, when you think of like a river that leads into a lake, is there a spirit of the river and a spirit of the lake? And is there a spirit of the entire watershed? And my answer is generally yes to all of that.
Yeah. And there's a spirit of like all lakes.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You can, there's like the oversoul of, a species of tree, the oversoul of rivers, and things like that. It gets real, I don't know. It gets into like you start sounding like a hippie, like who's had too many bong rips or something. And, but it's, I don't know. It's just, it feels, this is my worldview, and this is the worldview of many people. So, you just kind of want to take it where it goes.
Yeah. And I think for me, it's partly looking at things that way, like looking at the world that way or the universe that way, helps my brain wrap around why magic works. Mm-hmm. Because if everything really is connected and there's no separation between us, then every time you tap on a string, you're tapping on everything.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And it also brings up interesting ethical dilemmas when doing magic, that, like, is it even magic that is generally seen as positive? Is it, is it ethical to do magic at all? Is it, but then you can take that to an even further extreme, and it's like, well, is it ethical to exist, because of the impact that you have just existing? So, and then that makes the arguments you get into about, like, is is it ethical to do magic? Well, I'm in this world and I have agency in this world. And, you know, my desire is to do as little harm as possible, but I am still an integral part of this whole, you know, so.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, my consumption is harmful on some level, but then I too will be consumed.
Yeah.
It's an interesting, I mean, I think it is one of those things like, I'm really looking forward to the second book if you can't tell.
One of the things that I have flagged for to cover in the second book is the personal decomposition, you know, and consumption of yourself after your life is over. And have you heard of Recompose? They're an organization that started there somewhere in the Northwest. Maybe around Seattle, I can't remember, maybe Seattle. But they have, basically they use fungi to decompose a human body and break a human body down.
It's like human composting.
Yeah. So I just love this idea. I think it's like the most magical thing. And so the idea of like becoming garden soil after I go is like the happiest like idea that I could imagine.
Yeah. Well, I think especially in the book you talk about like the fairy traditions idea about the three souls.
Yeah.
I have never studied fairy tradition specifically, but it comes up a lot because so many people who write books have that in their lineage. And it's been really interesting me to think about like the multi-part soul and it's like, you know, if you're, you know, if the animal part of you returns to the earth and becomes that, like, that's really beautiful. But then you get, and you know, if that's what you think happens to everybody, then you're like, well, ancestor veneration is complicated. Like, but not if we're a multi-part soul, then that explains it.
Right.
So I think it, I don't know. I really liked the way you talked about it in the book. And it's one of those things like, oh, maybe I need to dive a little deeper on that. Yeah.
And it's not just fairy tradition that has the multi-part soul. It's in Temple of Witchcraft, but it's also, I mean, it's a really old concept.
Like even Egyptian, right? I mean, it goes.
Yeah. And there is some like, even in old Celtic, like, folklore or lore or mythology or whatever, they have like multiple cauldrons and you know that are, you know, make up your souls. And so there's, you know, it's definitely out there. And it's something that when I first was exposed to it, I was like, oh, this makes so much sense. Like you know, you have these different aspects of yourself that carry on in different ways after you die, you know, and sort of getting all of those souls in alignment is kind of the work of the witch, or the work of this witch.
I think, I don't know, it's just one of those things, like sometimes you just come across a concept and you're like, oh, well, that explains this thing that I've never understood, or like, you know, this thing that's like never quite worked right in my worldview. And you're like, oh, somebody else already thought about this. which is why I am a book witch, I guess. One of the things I was thinking about is like, you talked a little bit about like doing research and pre-writing for the new book. So just what does that process look like for you? Like what does, when you have an idea, like how do you dig in?
Well, most of my ideas actually come when I'm on walks. Like I'm walking through our watershed here, which is all like wetlands, and it's the time that I'm connecting most, you know, obviously with nature because I'm in it, but I'm also connecting with sort of the spirit of my creativity and just allowing free thought to flow. And being inspired by what I'm seeing around me, you know, and So that's where like most of my ideas come from that. And then I bring it home and just start journaling about it. You know, maybe even on the trail, I'll like write a little note on my phone, just so I remember it. And then I start looking into, you know, doing research and, you know, has this ever been, you know, like, is this a new idea or is this an idea that somebody else has come up with before that I just have never encountered? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, start doing, I like to do some scholarly research to, you know, back up the main points of what I've written. So I have a friend who has jailbroken JSTOR for me. They work for an educational foundation, so mm-hmm. I have access to their login and mm-hmm. and get to
that's nice, yeah.
Run around in there a lot, and you know that's a good place. And then I just read pretty widely in the sciences and like popular science writing, like mm-hmm. Michael Pollan is mm-hmm. one of my favorite writers. Mm-hmm. And just see, you know, what they have to say, and then look at who they're referencing. So looking through their notes and seeing, oh, who is this? Should I look into them? This point correlates with it. It gets, you know, very, as I said, I've spent some time as a project manager, so I get very project managey about mm-hmm. it, where I'm like, okay, well, I've got this idea, so it needs to have, you know, I need to do some research around it and find out who, you know, try to find some original sources, see what other popular writers are saying, and, you know, and then just dig into that. So that's kind of my process. And then at some point I get frustrated and I'm like, enough research, I can't handle it anymore, and I just start writing, and then it's on from there.
Yeah, I think that I don't know. I'm currently working on my first like long form nonfiction thing, and yeah, sometimes the research is like getting in the way of writing. It's like I just want to write, but I need to know this fact, and I need to know it to write the next thing. So yeah,
right.
It's like as much as I love the research part, sometimes it does get in the way, or you get down a rabbit trail that winds up not being fruitful for the current thing,
oh, yeah,
but set you on a path for something else later. And you're like, okay, I can't do this right now.
Yeah. I'm such a magpie when it comes to all of this stuff. I'm like, mm-hmm. oh, shiny. What's that shiny thing over there? Yeah. I need that. Like I need to store this for later. Mm-hmm. And it just.
Yes. Oh no, I feel you on that 100%. I think one of the things that you brought up in the book and then you kind of touched on again there is getting your ideas when you walk, and how like in our current screen infested social media world, like it's so hard to be bored.
Yeah.
And it's so important to be bored.
Vitally important. I think creativity is the source of creativity, mm-hmm. you know? And if you don't allow yourself to be bored, you're not going to challenge yourself to think mm-hmm. more deeply about different things, or even consider other points of view that you know had not considered before. So yeah, I think it's limiting screen time is so important, and it's something that I don't even do. Like I need to have a better regimen for myself mm-hmm. on it. But it's something, you know, in my son's life we have, you know, extremely curtailed screen time, and like he doesn't even like movies at the end, which is crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not crazy, but it's, you know, so many children his age have been raised on like Disney movies or mm-hmm. whatever. And he can't handle them because they're just too immersive mm-hmm. and oftentimes very violent, but
yeah.
which he doesn't like either. But so I think, but by limiting the screen time, he engages in play more, he engages in art more, he just sits and does math like for fun. So and it's, you know, he is a great example to me, reinforcing that I need to get more on top of it myself, you know, for myself.
Well, and like in the middle of this push for the book launch, that's even harder because like
you,
I mean, you're encouraged in marketing to, you know, post this many times a day and comment on other people's posts and blah, 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 blah. You're like, this is stealing my brain.
It is. Yeah. And I'm not a huge fan of social media in the first place. I think, you know, like Facebook came around and I think I was 24 when it was made publicly available.
Mm-hmm.
And I was almost at the cusp of being just too old to jump on and be like an early adopter for it. But I tried it. And I think I always look back on that and I'm like, I wish I had waited. Because, you know, so much of my life since then has been lived through social media.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always had just this, like, you know, a real argument with myself about, you know, if it's a valid way to spend your time, you know.
Yeah. And I think, you know, Facebook to me, especially, is one of those that's like, I mean, I think TikTok and Instagram and like the image stuff is one thing, but I think there's something about Facebook that's different. And I suspect that's why a lot of younger people have stepped away is that it's this like weird, intimate peek into people's lives that if it weren't for social media, you might have occasionally thought about this person, but they're not immediate to your life.
Right.
And so it's like this artificial inflation of your circle.
Yeah.
In a way that is like emotionally draining, I think, for people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I have lots of thoughts about it that I haven't coalesced into like an overall theory of why I think social media is bad for us.
Yeah.
Other people are saying it much more cogently than I am. But like, I think that's one of the ones, like this artificial inflation of what it means to be popular, even. Like, there was this great article about, you know, like when you're trying to promote something and you publish a post, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, whatever. Probably not Twitter these days. And then like 1,000 people like it and you're disappointed that 1,000 people liked this post.
Yeah.
And before social media, if 1,000 people knew you existed, you would be shocked.
Yeah. Right.
If 1,000 people were in a room to listen to you, you would be overjoyed.
Right.
But this makes it seem artificially small. Yeah. Or terrified. Yeah. Depending on your relationship to public speaking.
Right.
But yeah. Like it's just so skewed our idea of what it means to connect with other people.
Yeah, absolutely. It's akin to like radioactive material, you know, mm-hmm. like the more exposure to it you have, the more like kind of sick you become with it, you know, and it becomes it's almost an addictive thing too, you know, like if your post does really well, then, I need to mm-hmm. post another one, you know, and see if I can get the same amount of
dopamine,
you know,
hit. Likes.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So, yeah.
Yeah. I just feel like it's so changed our idea about what success looks like too. Like I think about, you know, in the midst of all of that merger that didn't happen between a couple of the big publishing houses. When they were saying that, you know, 50% of the books that they publish sell less than 12 copies.
Yeah.
50% of the books sell less than 12 copies. And I've heard independently published people say, you know, I'm really disappointed. My books only sold 500 copies. And I was like, do you realize what that
you
means?
You beat the odds. Yeah.
You beat 50% of books published by major publishing houses if you've sold 500 copies of your book.
But
it's a disappointment.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. And there's a lot of different factors that go into that too. I used to work at a Barnes & Noble and I just remember remaindering all of the paperback books that would come in, which for those who don't know, remaindering is essentially where you tear the cover off of the book and throw the book away.
Mm-hmm.
And you send the cover back to the publisher as proof that their book didn't sell.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like a heartbreaking thing for me to just sit there and rip the covers off of all of these books and just be like, somebody put so much work into this.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's But, you know, the publishing industry, even back then, was pushing out such volume that they weren't able to adequately market the material that they were putting out, you know, when it was still their job to do that. Very few publishing houses do much in the way of marketing at all anymore. So
it's a strange business, that's for sure. And yeah. I, you know, seeing it from multiple sides, you just start to realize like how strange it is. Okay. Well, cool. Well, we try to keep the podcast to an hour because that's my attention span these days. But I also think, you know, when I look at podcasts and I'm like, oh, 3.5 hours, like I don't have time for that right now.
Right.
So I think an hour is a good run, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of plug what's coming up for you. I said, this will come out in the beginning of October and like where people can find you, and then we'll do our game of chance question.
Great. So yeah, this is going to be in October. So I'm going to be appearing at the end of October at the Florida Pagan Gathering in Silver Springs, Florida. It's October 25th through the 29th. I'm one of the headliners for that event. And then I will have just gotten back from making appearances at Summer Magic in Orlando in June, and Mystic South in July in Atlanta, and Temple Fest with the Temple of Witchcraft in September. So those are appearances that will have already have happened. And yeah, so in the next year, I'm going to be, after all of the appearances are kind of wound down, I'm going to, you know, knuckle down and get to work on the next book, which I don't know. It's probably not coming out in 2024, or if it does, it'll be towards the end of 2024. It's probably 2025.
Okay.
But yeah.
That's the other thing I think sometimes people don't know about publishing is that tail is from when it finishes to when it appears in the world is very long. It's
very long. Yeah. I finished Path of the Moonlit Hedge in June, end of June 2022. Mm-hmm. I think that, So
a year really between when you finished and when it came out.
That was a really rapid, they fast tracked me to get it out more quickly because I wanted to be out for the summer. But yeah, it's usually even longer than that. Mine was, I think, a few months quicker than what they usually do.
So our last question is a tiny game of chance.
Okay.
And you live in the South, so you know the things you're not supposed to talk about in polite company.
Right.
That witches like to talk about, especially, you know, those of us who play into our Scorpio-ness, who don't like to make small talk. So I will roll a die, and depending on what number I get, you will get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. And if I roll a 6, you get to pick which one you want. There are no rules to the game. So if you're like, nah, I don't want to answer that one, we'll do a different one.
Okay.
6, you get to pick which one.
Okay. Let's see. How about politics? I was going to say death, but maybe politics.
Maybe politics. Okay. So based on what we talked about, I think I might change my question a little bit. Because it's usually like what obligations do witches have in the world as in and politics, but you live in a very specific place right now. And so I was kind of wondering, like, what is it like to move through the world as an occultist, a pagan, a witch in a place that has really moved into far right extremism in a lot of ways? Like how do you navigate that world right now?
You know, I'd be lying if I didn't say carefully. It's hard as somebody who is a publicly out witch and pagan. It's a rough time in this state for sure. But I also know so many people here who are not in that far right. You know, mm-hmm. it's the thing that I always have to fall back on, that I always have to remind myself, is that these people are in charge, but they're not the majority.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, you know, the Republican Party gerrymandered all of the voting districts, and, you know, I vote in the same block as people 70 miles away, doesn't mean that I'm, you know, that there aren't still good people in this state, and that there are, and there are, you know, there is resistance that's happening, and it's increasing. And I think what I'm seeing internally that may not be so exposed externally is the amount of disgust that people have over over the things that are happening in the state, to the point that, like, people who live here are almost revolted by what is going on. And it, I mean, it's obviously it that would be a natural reaction to have. But, you know, I don't think that this is something that is going to, it's not a sustainable track for the people who are on the far right end of the spectrum. This is not something that's going to keep moving forward without any sort of counterbalance, counterchecks happening.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting to see, like, even people who consider themselves on the right or Republicans are like, yeah, but not like this. Yeah. Like, this isn't what we want either.
Yeah. Yeah, there are. I mean, there are plenty of conservative people who I've talked to here who are. They don't like, they think that the what DeSantis is doing is just sort of a clown show. And they, you know, like, he's trying to really up his profile for a presidential election, but, and he's just trying to out Trump, you mm-hmm. know, and that's, and being in charge of a state is a really great way to show that you can out Trump. And it's scary. And, you know, I would be lying if I didn't say that we have had multiple conversations about moving, but
mm-hmm.
you know, when your life is set up in a place and it's been set up for a long time, it's hard to uproot that, you know, it's hard to quit jobs and, you know, end relationships and everything that it would entail to escape.
Yeah. And I think that's something that people are like, well, you should just move. And I'm like, okay. I mean, we did move from Tennessee to California, but it was for a job. It wasn't 100% to escape Tennessee. Right. But, you know, it's like, but this is where, like you said, this is where people's lives are. Like, you know, and even now at a distance, like, I'm so disgusted with some of the stuff going on in Tennessee. And I'm like, this is not who my neighbors were. This is not who my community was. Like, where are these people coming from? Like, this is not, you know, and like, I think that idea that you're just going to write off a whole region of the US because it's the South. And I'm like, you know, it's also like, the part of the country that has the highest Black population. So you're basically telling me that you're just going to write off, you know, the majority of Black people in the United States because right. they're in the South. I was like, you know, that's crazy to me. And, and also not productive. Like, he said they're good people, and gerrymandering has made it look like there are no blue dots anymore. And I'm like, you'd be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's gerrymandering that's made our state a supermajority Republican state. You know?
Tennessee is exactly the same. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a frustrating time. And, you know, I feel like I am actually more safe than many of my friends here. You know, I'm a white, you know, apparently cishet male. So the cards are kind of stacked in my favor in that way, you know, and there are many of my friends who are, you know, seriously looking at leaving, and I don't want them to. I would I don't want to lose them for my life, but I understand why they would, you know, and where the motivation comes from.
When you're looking at a target on your back, that's different. And I don't,
I
don't fault those people for leaving. I mean, I don't fault anybody who decides that they need to leave, but, if you are the population being targeted, if you need to leave, you need to leave. And for a lot of those people, it's not possible either for financial or family or, you know, obligation, other obligations, like that's not possible.
Which makes it all the more, just important that people do speak up about these things. And, you know, like seeing all of these books getting banned from my child's school, I'm like, what? This is ridiculous. Like, I do not subscribe to any of the ideology that's powering this movement. And as a taxpaying citizen of this county, like, it's my responsibility and right to have representation, to seek other, to have other viewpoints available to my child, you know? And so,
it's like the idea of parental rights, but not all parents.
Right.
You know, and I'm like, exactly. That's problematic. I'm like, you're talking out of both sides of your mouth, and we all know it. But I think one of the things that I was like to end on kind of a hopeful note, I think one of the things that is good to see is that people are really starting to speak up, and in places where sometimes it's not even safe for them to do that, people are still going, no, this is not okay. And I think that we all have to be heartened by that. And we all have to stand up with them in the ways that we can. Absolutely. I mean, not everybody can be public, but.
And, you know, nor should they be if they don't feel safe to do so.
Right, but, exactly.
But yeah, we definitely, I am encouraged by the amount of people saying, this is not who we are, who we want to be. This is not the culture that we want to create. So.
I still have hope. I mean, I know that sometimes that seems almost Pollyanna in the face of things happening, but I still have hope.
Yeah, I do too. And, you know, I dedicated this book to my son, in the end with a very hopeful, note to him, you know, that, so I think that the seeing things like animism, and witchcraft spreading and, becoming, it's not mainstreamed, but it's more, readily available than it ever has been, in my opinion. It gives me some hope that, you know, maybe people will be able to turn their, you know, attention, their opinions, and their actions to better and, you know, more hopeful activities.
I hope so too. Awesome. Well, Nathan, thank you so much for being on, and thank you for writing this lovely book.
Thank you.
And I'm looking forward to the second one, and come back on and talk about that when that comes out.
Awesome. I will.
Awesome. Take care.
Thank you.
Witchlit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shenekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witchlit.